Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Peg McManus, thank you so much for coming and joining us on this beautiful day.
It's glorious.
How are you? I've been so looking forward to this conversation because you've a book coming out this week called I Will Be Good, and it's about your remarkable life in Dublin. It's a journey that begins in a tenement building on North King Street during the Second World War to an Ireland that would be completely unrecognisable to us now.
Absolutely.
What was it like? You have such a sharp and vivid memory of the tenements.
No, it was, we all lived in one room, you know. We had a small family. Eventually, there were three children and two adults. And we slept, my sister and I slept at the bottom of our parents' bed, and my young brother slept in a kind of a lean-to in a cot. And we had no toilets. The toilets, I'm sure everybody's heard this all before. A cone, a cone, a cone. But we had no toilets. And the toilet was downstairs. And there was a bucket in the room where people did their wee.
Yeah.
And there were gas mantles. There was no electricity in that room at the time. And there was I can actually see the room in my mind's eye. And I can see the light coming in through the curtains. And it was dark. But children don't have a sense of there being another way of life. So that was okay.
For you at the time, like, when you talk about your parents' generation, you know,
yes,
they lived through two world wars,
yeah,
a civil war, the foundation of a new state, and rampant poverty and disease. And you say in the book, it had all been shrouded in a veil of silence, covered up with lace curtains and respectability.
When, yes.
It was a hard life for them.
It was a hard life. It was a hard life. And you know what? One of the reasons I'm so delighted I wrote that book was it in tribute to my parents. And I feel sad when I think about it. But one of the things I remember is, yes, it was a hard life. Yes, they were materially deprived. But they had each other. There was a sense of community. Now, I'm not romanticising.
But in the tenements, people were rearing each other.
This
in a
is
sense.
It. This is it. And children reared each other. And, I mean, one of the things is, I mean, children did get burned and scalded, as would happen. But children learned to negotiate things. There was no fire guards, so you stayed away from the fire. Do you know what I mean? Children learned how to deal with life. They weren't shielded from it. And so they became resilient. Well, you either went under or swam. Yeah. That was the way it was. Parents, I mean, my God, they devised ways of living together.
And surviving.
Of surviving, of sharing what they had. And one of the things I remember,
including their songs, they seem to sing endlessly in this book.
That's right. They were, my mother, I knew, don't know why, there's no sun up in the sky, stormy weather. And they had duets, they had parties. They sang, and one of the things was as well, they talked to each other. See, the people would sit around the fire and talk to each other. And you could call, knock on somebody's door and say, could I have a lump of a cup of sugar? Or you could knock on somebody's door and you could tell them, I'm not feeling great. Or there was that. They were each other's counsellors.
How come you've such a sharp recall of those times, because, you know, you were quite young at the time.
That's right. That's right. One of the things I wonder, I have a very good memory, and I wonder, this might sound a bit mad, I was hard of hearing.
As a child?
Always. I got an infection, and, you know, I was always, as a child, I was, and I heard everything wrong sometimes, you know. But I think I developed another sense because I had to concentrate on so hard on what people were saying. And then, of course, I had a vivid imagination. So yeah. My mother used to say to me, imagination is half your life.
Miss, maybe it's not a bad thing.
No.
It was really interesting, you know, on the news headlines this morning, constantly we're talking about the need to build, you know, the social housing.
Yes.
We're complaining we're not building enough social housing. But you were part of that big wave that saw you move out of the tenements into what was the Wild West at that time of Cabra.
Oh, absolutely. It was a vast clearance. Just coming up to the end of the war, I mean, there was Drimna, Cabra, Ballyfermot, Walkinstown, Whitehall, all of those places were built.
And was it a big change in your living circumstances?
Oh, totally. I mean, we went up on the bus, I remember, and we went into this maze of housing, round and round and round, and eventually we got to our house, Broombridge Road was at the top of the hill, and they opened the front door and we ran in through the door and up the stairs was immediately, and we switched on the water and we flushed the chain, and it was just so amazing. And then we ran out to the garden and picked all the daffodils and posted them through the letterbox.
You also said that with that, obviously on the one hand, there was a big increase in your living standards.
Yes.
But you also describe how there was almost like a sense of shame sort of being moved out. Was that a class issue?
Oh, absolutely it was, yeah. But I don't think anybody, you see, we weren't conscious of class. I never knew what class was. But when I remember my father saying, oh, it'll do till we get our own house. Because there was a sense of wanting to own your own house. And then all the people, so we didn't know, there was no policemen, there were no teachers, there were no solicitors, there were no, they lived in another place. And for some strange reason, now, it was probably half imagined. When I got to the convent, we thought that the people from the private houses got better treatment than us.
Was that your first sort of awareness?
It was my first consciousness of class and idea, or even accent or language. Because I remember, I think I put in the book, when the little girl said, oh, miss, I want to do me wig, can I go to the lab? And she said, you can, but you may not. So this young woman wet the floor. She didn't know what about grammar.
Which can be critical.
yes, exactly.
You know, you think back, we're actually doing an item soon on kind of, you know, kids and money and
yeah.
Holy Communion. When you think back to those early landmarks of coming of age, you know, did you get much for your communion?
£2 something. For my £2, 4 shillings, and I can't remember, some £2 anyway, in threepenny bits, little well, and I kept counting them back and forth. And then the next day, my mother just removed the £2.
Took the whole lot off?
She took the whole lot, but she no money. And she bought wool to knit 2 cardigans for my sister Bridie, and I hated them with a passion. And I remember, you talked about memory, it was a box stitch. I can see it as clear as daylight.
You've stayed away from red cardigans ever since. Like many people of your generation, the women in particular, formal education ended for you at a young age. Is that
That's
something
right.
you resented or
well,
sad about?
On reflection, I mean, I went out to work and so when you went out to work, first of all, you had to find a job. Now, that was a skill in itself, going for an interview, because nobody told you what to say, got into town, went for a job. So you got a job. So when you got a job, then you were contributing to your family. Now, I did have a sense of that. I mean, a sense of pride in that. Sometimes I might have stayed in school, but I didn't. But the things I learned how to get on with people. I learned how to be on time. I learned how to ride a bicycle. I learned how to manage money. That was the university of life. Now, I consider that is an education. And I consider that I later on went back and you know, did lots of courses and became different things. I don't resent it now, funnily enough. Now, with hindsight, I think I learned so much.
Yeah. The title of your memoir is I Will Be Good. And for me, this memoir, in many ways, is you talking to your younger self, going
yes.
back to that little girl who never felt she was good enough.
Yes.
And reassuring her that you were. And that's a very, very sad sort of reflection because, like many women in Ireland at that time and since, there was a big moment in your life when, as the narrative then went, you brought disgrace
yes.
on your family. Can you share that with us?
Well, I had a baby outside of marriage. It really makes me feel sad when I think about it now. And I was engaged, I was going to be married, I was living in Scotland, and my fiancé went to sea. He was an engineer and a chef, and he didn't want to get married. And so I was left in Scotland by myself when he left. And I thought of all the possibilities. And I went in, then I was in the Legion of Mary. So I went to the priest that I knew and I told him my predicament. I had to move out of where I was living and
you
go into a hostel.
Job.
Yeah. I lost my job. And he got me a place in a home for unmarried mothers, which I have to say, the nuns were very kind.
This was in Scotland?
In Scotland, they were very kind. And really, we ran the place. The nuns merely supervised. But it wasn't a case of us doing all the work. And it was almost like a co-op. And so it was sad, you know.
Because you talk about how there was a need to protect your brothers and sisters.
Oh, my God.
The wider family, the shame of...
Well, nobody knew I was in that home. I used to write, send money from a different, you know, if you had any money you sent at home. And so when I had Marie, I decided I would come home and see if I could keep her. So I came home and I realised, and I told my parents, I mean, my heart goes out to parents of that time. We cannot understand this time, at this time, what it was like for them. And it was a madness, really. But I felt so sad for them. And I came home and I realised, no. And they were afraid that I had a young brother, two young brothers and a sister at home. And they were afraid they'd be tainted by the shame of me having a baby. And also that they might go astray as well. There was that whole sense of utter shame and silence. So I went back to Scotland and I decided I'd have Marie adopt her. And I actually wrote to my fiancé's mother, who came down, and she couldn't believe that I'd had a child. Now, I have to say, I think she would have taken me in, But at that time, I was so distraught. I couldn't think of other options. So I had Marie adopted, and probably it was the thing that most affected me for a whole lifetime.
And you obviously, to some extent, buried that for a long time when you when you met your husband. At, I think you say it was the sort of the unspoken shadow.
Yes.
In
now he knew I told him.
Yeah, but it was sort of the unspoken shadow in your marriage.
That's so, right.
Something happened, as happens in life, that makes you pivot, or perhaps breaks you free from that prison of shame and silence. What was that for you?
Well, I went into counselling, really. And that was an absolute turning point in my life. The first thing that I could tell somebody to speak about it. And then it was everything. I mean, it was the changing point, the fact that I could say it out loud. And then in counselling, I could look back at myself and see how. I mean, what's my book? I Will Be Good. Yes. That was my motto. But not alone did I want to be good, but I wanted to save the world. It was my mission.
Describe that reevaluation maybe of where you came from and finally begin, you know, having permission, a coming out, if you will, made you change your name.
Oh yes,
what was that about?
Yes, absolutely. Well, there was a few things. When my mum was in good form and she liked me, you know, she called me Peg.
Like the old Peg, Peg Sayers.
Mammy did never hear the Peg Sayers, but it was her pet name for me. Yeah. She wouldn't say Peggy when I heard Peggy, but she'd say Peg in that tone. And I had a sense of that, being loved or something about it. And then also I met a marvellous nun called Margaret McCurtain. And her name was Peg, and I knew her, and I just admired her so much. And then everything, I thought, I want to be Peg. So I changed the Irish, P-E-I-G.
That big reveal, that acknowledging Marie and that time of your life had a huge impact on your own marriage and family life, but unlike many mothers who find themselves in your situation, you did get a chance to meet your daughter.
Oh, yes. And I have to say that my husband was really, he wrote to the adoption agency. He was fully supportive. Once it was out, it's the fear of something coming out. That's what we're all afraid of. And when something's out, it's not a fear anymore because it's out. So he wrote to the adoption agency, and within 6 weeks, I got a letter back, and she'd been looking for me for 7 years, and she was going to get a private detective. So I met her when she was pregnant with her first child. And honestly,
what was it like, that first experience?
My God, I mean, all your children you love, but it was like looking into my own soul. Just amazing. Just amazing.
And isn't there something, Peg, about the destructive power of shame and keeping secrets?
I really think that I don't know how we managed it in Ireland. I was listening to President Higgins last night. He's talking about the famine. And I think there is some connection, honestly, ancestrally, about being poor, poverty, outcast. We took it from somewhere. Maybe it was colonialism, wherever it came from, and the church.
But, and you're right, and, you know, we've often spoken that on the programme about that time, the time of your parents, how we internalised a lot of that shame,
exactly,
perhaps.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting about your book, and there's so many funny laugh-out-loud parts in it as well, but it is the role of spirituality in your life, because you were actually working for Crosscare, which is a Catholic organisation.
That's right.
Which you said actually helped you back on your path to spirituality.
Yes.
And to faith.
That's right. Oh, yes. To be honest with you, I think spiritual, whatever we may term that as, you know, is essential. Well, it certainly was essential to me. And I wanted to go and, you know, save the world. I didn't see it in the Catholic sense. But I wanted to go out and, I suppose, to be good, whatever that means. Yes.
Because it's right through the book, all through the book, you're like,
is
I
it?
Will be good. I wanted to be good. And
yes.
And my heart was trying to reach out like you and reassure that little girl, you know.
Yes.
And it's so interesting because you're critical of the church, but you also examine the damage done by the ban on contraception and the expectation that women would be nearly pregnant at all times back at that earlier stage and phase.
That's right. I look, the other thing is, I think we've gone, you know the way things go. I was one of the people who kind of fought for women to go to work and contraception and all of those things. And we have come a huge long way.
Have we gone too far?
I think so. But I think that always happens in all movements.
So once you didn't have a choice to work, you might have been stopped from working, and now perhaps a lot of women will say they've no choice but to.
Well, look, it's been grabbed, I know, by capitalism. Before my husband and I got married, he was a postman, he had very small wages. We managed to get a deposit on a house. We got a house. I stayed at home, and I could stay at home. My youngest child was 7, but I could do that. Now people have no choice.
Your liberation from the home could actually be made into a movie. I loved the part where you went to an ashram and give out to the guru because there was no men in the kitchen. And there were other parts. It's before the watershed, so I won't do some of the other very revealing things that happened in the book. But one of the things is that in the middle of all of this, you became something of a feature in Irish media.
I think you've said
a kind of working class novelty. But for someone who had so much internal shame and silence, you find your voice in so many different ways, including in this station.
That's right. Oh, yes. Once I was let free, I shot out like a bird out of a cage. I couldn't be shut up. I say they were all sick of me. My kids used to hide when I'd be on television and say, oh, my God.
Did you enjoy that?
I did. I did. I enjoyed it. But I enjoyed it for what it was, you know, but it wouldn't have been what I wanted to do.
What would you have wanted to do?
Well, I do think I would like...
You still want to be a good girl, or are
you
thinking?
I think that's for, you know, karma, and about 10 lives forward. what I was going to say is, do you know what I'd love to have been? A stand-up comedian.
I think you could do it already, Peg. There's one particular chapter which I won't go into detail. It's called The Mirror Within.
Oh, and, my God.
And I thought, well, if there's ever something that could be stand-up comedy, it might have to come with a little bit of a warning. I'm so glad that you did find your voice. You said when you went into counselling, you told your counsellor, and I think it's something that a lot of people experience, but in my own experience, a lot of women say that when they look back, they just said, I wish I'd had more confidence.
Yes.
And is that something that when you're looking back that you wish you'd had? Is that what you're saying to that younger Peg, you know, who's saying, I'm going to be good, I will be good?
I don't know, to be honest with you. I think it's a life's journey. I honestly think That was my life's journey, and I learned it when I got confidence. It came from within, to some extent. Yeah. To you. It was in there and came out. It wasn't something that was imposed from without.
I want to share with you before I let you go, Peg. Yes. There's far too many. I can't go through them all. I can't get out of my car. I'm blown away by that interview. I feel such love in my heart for Peg. Another listener says, wishing kindness and peace to Peg. Please mind yourself. Another says, Derval, I am transfixed by your beautiful guest. She's an iconic woman. Oh, continued success and happiness to her. Another says, Peg is wonderful. Her reminiscence about her time in the tenements and the stories and connections is a reminder of how technology has intruded so much in our lives. If I ask my neighbours for some sugar, I'd first have to introduce myself, says another. Just before I let you go, what advice now would you give to that younger girl who is just trying to be good?
I just say, you are a lovely little girl. You are good.
And she turned out brilliant. Peg. Thank you so much, Peg McManus. The book is called I Will Be Good and it's out on Thursday. It's published by Hachette. It has been an absolute honour, Peg. Thank you for coming in to see me today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Email brendan@rte.ie.